Racism isn't about how you look. It's about how people assign meaning about how you look. That's a quote drawn from a wonderful new exhibit on race, which is currently touring the country from the American Anthropological Association. We'll be getting a look at that exhibit this hour as we explore race through a biological, cultural, and historical lens. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to be with you. Well, every person is as different as a snowflake, and we know that from those differences come a lot of joy and a lot of sorrow. With Barack Obama as a frontrunner for the Democratic ticket in November, it seems like a good time to stop a moment or two and take a look at how race divides us and unites us. We're talking this hour with two guests from the American Anthropological Association about their current project, Race. Are We So Different? We'll be talking with Yolanda Moses. She's the Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Conflict Resolution and Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Riverside. And Michael Blakey, the National Endowment for the Humanities Professor of Anthropology and the Director at the Institute for Historical Biology at the College of William and Mary. Yolanda and Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you for having us.
So give me a sense. I gather this exhibit isn't touring Wisconsin at the moment, but can you tell me if we were to go there today, what would we expect to see?
Well, you'd expect to see a 5,000-square-foot exhibit that looks at the issue of race from three different perspectives. That is, the science of race, what it is and what it isn't, the history of race, particularly in the United States, and also how it's lived, how people experience race in this country in their everyday lives.
And this is an interactive exhibit, right? You've got some computer. I mean, I spend a lot of time exploring the website, and at least there you have some quizzes. You have first-person stories about what it means to be, you know, maybe a black girl growing up, or...
Sure.
And you've got the scientific perspective and the historical perspective. Can you tell me how those pieces all kind of fit together?
Well, and Michael, you chip in, of course. What we were trying to do is not proselytize and preach to people. We wanted them to understand the complexity of the issue. And we also wanted to have parents, when they brought their children, to be able to talk about what they were seeing. So we teamed up with the Science Museum of Minnesota, who has an excellent reputation for translating complex scientific information to public audiences. And so we worked with them for several years to conceptualize how to do it. So it wasn't something that just came out of, you know, anthropologists' heads. We also had to learn how to translate our ideas. And those interactive activities were a way to engage young people in figuring out through the scientific process the concepts we were trying to make, that race is not biological, but it is a cultural concept.
Well, Michael Blakey, you come at it from the scientific point of it. Does race exist? Is there any basis for saying that, yes, in if we look at DNA, we take your blood, we can tell you something about race?
Well, race does not exist as it was initially believed to exist, and that is initially believed to be a fact of nature, an intrinsic natural category of populations based on a combination of traits. We now know that each, and have known for 50 years, that each biological trait is distributed in its own way, independently of other biological traits, across the human sea around the world. What we have in America, for example, is a history in which certain traits were identified as ways of pointing to certain groups of people of African descent, or people of Native American descent, as appropriate for certain categories of political and economic life, i.e., in the case of people of African descent, that they could be enslaved, as opposed to people of European descent who had the full rights of human beings. And so this is actually a practice of legitimizing social differences and economic differences that came to be based on biology, or a crude folk sense of biology that was emerging in the 1700s and the 1800s. Prior to that time, justifications of the enslavement of Africans or the full humanity of Western Europeans was based on religious differences. But as science grew up under these circumstances of the need to justify, it incorporated and developed race. So race is really a social distinction that has historically used biological markers in a situation in which people who are very darkly pigmented came to live with people who were very low pigmented.
Well, I guess listening to you talk, it sort of begs the question, is it time to do away with the construct of race? Is it proven its worth in the past, but maybe it's time to move on, and maybe now it's more divisive a construct than it is helpful? What do you think, Yolanda Moses?
Well, that's certainly easier said than done. We got into this project in the late 90s because we were asked by the Census Bureau to help them validate some of the categories they had. And as an association, we basically said, these don't make sense. Why do you have people categorized the way you do? And the response back, well, we know it's not biologically, doesn't biologically make sense, but for bureaucratic purposes, we want to work with them because some of these categories have been in place since, 1790, and we don't want to change them.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that kind of resistance. And I think that the idea of race, what we're trying to do in our exhibit is to say that biologically what people are looking at is not race. They're looking at human variation when they say different. But race is culturally and socially constructed, and that is something I do not think we're going to do away with until we understand it, that is, how it is constructed. Once we do that, then I think we have a better chance of understanding how to deconstruct it or do away with it.
Well, could we talk instead about culture and lose the race part? Is that possible to do?
Yes, that's what this exhibit is about. It's about moving us away from an essentialist biological explanation and saying it is, in fact, a cultural and a social explanation we should be using. And the history in this exhibit shows us how exactly it happened and where we are today. So we do stand at a very interesting place in our society. Emblematic or symbolic of the presidential race, both for Obama but also for Hillary Clinton as well,
mm-hmm.
that, we have an opportunity to take these socially constructed categories and have them lose a kind of power and meaning that they've had in our past.
Well, if I could follow up, it's important to recognize that racism exists. Institutionalized racism is pervasive still within American life. Studies of access to jobs, to loans, at least we have anecdotal data on access to the presidency of the United States, that all of these are these opportunities are affected by not just race, but the thing for which race has served, and that is racism, the perpetuation of white privilege at the expense of those who have been marked by race as being less deserving. There's the idea that had emerged with race within science, a sort of biodeterministic or imagination, the idea that our biology determines who and what we are and can become.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was the notion that people differed in their intelligence, in their capacity for civilization, in the kinds of health that they had, because of their biology. We now know that they're really very, there's no good evidence on intelligence differences between people of different races determined by their biology. There's very little in the way of disease that varies based on biology, but we do still seem to have this imagination that colors our expectations of people and that serves still a justification, not of slavery, but of privilege, and helps people explain what would appear on the face of it to be stark inequities as something natural. So we need to look at these phenomena, both in terms of the biology, to understand the real lack of evidence for a biological explanation for social and even most health differences. But at the same time, as we look at the social science, we understand that there are real environmental differences among groups of people that we have called races that can contribute even to high blood pressure, mortality rates, these kinds of biological effects.
And so what would you say, given all you've just said, is your great hope for the project and maybe for affecting change in the way we see race in the world?
Well, my hope for the project is that we educate the general public about the issue because, as Michael says, it comes up on so many levels. People talk about it, but they talk about it. They still tend to talk about it in essentialist ways. I think you wouldn't find people today saying overtly that people are biologically different and ranked in hierarchy with different kinds of aptitudes. I don't think people would say that. But I do think that because of the way the belief in these systems historically have become part of institutions in this society, that we don't even see them. For example, our laws and our customs and our institutions, some of the laws that are still on the books about redlining and about loans to, you know, people of different populations, it's to make visible some of the invisible ways in which our society continues to perpetuate this hierarchy of difference. Even if individual people say, well, I'm not that way, it's sometimes not about an individual as much as it is about how our institutions still perpetuate those inequalities. And so the exhibit is about explaining that to people who probably on any given day don't even think about the issue.
And have you gotten a sense so far? Have people come away changed?
Well, the feedback that we've gotten so far from the several museums that it's traveled to is that people tend to spend at least twice as much time at this exhibit than they do at normal or regular science exhibits. And they come back, and they interact, and they leave information, and they leave cards. We have places where people can interact. So it is something that people think about, and many people say, we think about it, but we don't know how to understand it. We don't know how to talk about it. And yes, we have been enlightened by some things. Now, we don't know whether it's going to change over the long haul, which is a part of why, you know, we want to go back and do research on people, you know, after the exhibit has been in a particular place to find out if, in fact, they have been changed.
We're talking this hour with Yolanda Moses, the Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Conflict Resolution and Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Riverside, and Michael Blakey, the National Endowment for the Humanities Professor of Anthropology and the Director of the Institute for Historical Biology at the College of William and Mary, talking with them about the new exhibit, Race, Are We So Different? If you'd like to explore the exhibit, we invite you to check it out online. It's pretty neat. I spent a long time there myself last night. It's www.understandingrace.org. You'll find some powerful testimonials there, some science, history, a bit of everything, really. That's www.understandingrace.org. We have an open phone line for you right now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We're wondering, does race still matter to you? Should it? And is it maybe time to do away with race? And how can we foster better communication and maybe a reality check about what race really is? That number, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. From 1 until 3 today, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday, live from Milwaukee. In that hour, the Great Lakes Water Compact, a look at the plan from the perspective of one member state, Wisconsin. Plus, we'll explore issues from pollution to invasive species and a report on the health of the lakes. That's Talk of the Nation Science Friday, live from Milwaukee today. Veronica Rickert back with you in Today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about an exciting new exhibit this hour. I believe currently it's showing in Minnesota. It's called Understanding Race at the website also www.understandingrace.org. Our guests are Yolanda Moses, Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Conflict Resolution at the University of California, Riverside, and Michael Blakey, who is the director of the Institute for Historical Biology at the College of William and Mary. And Yolanda and Michael, let's go ahead and take a phone call. This is Daryl calling from Delavan. Hi, Daryl, you're on the air.
Good morning, Veronica.
Morning.
Thank you, and your guests, and thank you so much for the program.
Sure.
When I talk to people about race, I've come to a point where I've created a short rhyme that kind of puts it into a perspective for me, if I might.
Sure.
Race is a case we're afraid to face. It's about black and white and red and green. We see too many colors. You know what I mean. It's like Mr. Clean with that gleam in his eye. You know he's watching, but why?
Did you write that?
Yes.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive.
Thank you.
And what do people say when you give them that rhyme?
Well, they wonder about the last line. You know, Mr. Clean with a gleam in his eye, you know he's watching, but why? Our society is pretty much to this point, you know, we have never had a woman. Well, we did have a woman running for president, but now we have a woman and a person of color running. But before that, it was all white presidents. And I think that's what it's all about. You know, Mr. Clean is watching, but why? You know, it's about the property. It's about the mineral resources, the timber, the laws. You know, it all enters into it. But that's just how I express it in a brief way.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that call, Daryl.
Thank you.
And Yolanda Moses,
yes.
You want to tell us what you think when you hear a rhyme like that? Do you see that as being something that's relevant to the exhibit?
Of course I do. And I think his last line especially is important because, you know, I think implicitly we all knew, you know, anthropologists, the history of this nation, but we have a particular place in the exhibit and the history where we show the pictures of every last president of the United States. And it is just incredible when you see it all lined up that they have all been white males.
Hmm.
And I say that because I don't think the impact of it, when you bring it all together, it is so clear the kind of leadership, the kind of schema that we've all sort of internalized is one where the leadership figure for our country always has been that. So the question is, are we ready for that change? Because we clearly have the opportunity to do that. And I think that's what you see people grappling with. Even if it's subconscious, that's what they're grappling with. Who is going to be our leader?
Do you think, Michael Blakey, that with the candidacy of Barack Obama, that race is being thrust into the spotlight in a way that is helpful, ultimately? Or do you think, given some of the things we've already seen about race politically, that it's going to be ultimately hurtful?
Well, it's always good to talk about it and to think about it. I think look, it's pretty obvious that race has had to enter into the discussion of the presidency because it is here, all around us, and influences how people perceive the rights and capacities of others. But it's a more complex discussion and in some ways a more hopeful discussion than might have happened 100 years ago. We, as a result of, the experience of Nazism, of the experiences of lynching, of the civil rights movement, all of these human rights efforts have led now to a society in which, in the United States, where segregation, racism, white supremacy are not legal, are not acceptable publicly. And so we have a society that is, in terms of public discourse, an anti-racist society to a large extent. And so people are very afraid, however, of speaking up and talking about the issues of race. They tend to go as code that not only often leads to more confusion, but embedded in it are really a number of ideas that support the continuation of the racial inequities. For example, the notion that, and I heard this in regard to Mr. Obama by one of the West Virginia interviewees, that they're just supporting him because he's black, and in some way that he's benefiting from this sort of perverse notion of affirmative action as undue privileges given to people who are assumed to be inadequate. And that's a very broad level of discourse among people who would often say, we're not racist. We're we have a level playing field. Affirmative action is the racist thing. And I think we saw some of that being pointed at Mr. Obama. What this reflects is the assumption that racism does not exist, that whites are not being privileged, and that the other, in this case blacks, are somehow innately undeserving of that level of influence. So in an anti-racist society, or society that does not tolerate, does not think racism or white supremacy to be legitimate, it's discussed in this very contorted way. We need to talk about it in an informed way.
So,
you see also our the media, the people who talk about it in the media aren't quite sure how to handle it either, because nobody wants to own the fact that they have said that Obama it cannot appeal to certain demographics. They always say, well, it's what the research showed as people were leaving the voting booths. It's sort of like the 2,000-pound elephant that sits on the table that nobody wants to talk about, but it's there all the time.
Well,
and what we hope we can do is to provide a way for people to talk about it.
Well, Barack Obama has addressed it head-on in a speech. This was, I guess, a month or so ago that many considered one of the great speeches of our time, and I believe this is from that speech. He said, on one end of the spectrum, we've heard the implication that my candidacy is somehow an exercise in affirmative action, that it's based solely on the desire of wide-eyed liberals to purchase racial reconciliation on the cheap. So he is addressing it, and it's being talked about, and as Michael Blakey said, this can only be a good thing to address these 100-pound elephants that are sitting on the table, as your exhibit is doing as well. And I think that this kind of feedback at this particular junction in time can only be a help.
And it's a help to our young people, too, because I'm reminded of the big national study that was done on Generation Y young people. they have grown up in environments that are a lot more diverse than, say, ourselves. And even in their own communities and in, you know, even in big Midwestern cities, you see the diversity that you hadn't seen before. And they are wanting to engage these issues, but sometimes their teachers don't, and sometimes their parents don't. So I'm thinking about the future. And if we're not giving young people who want to engage these issues a way to do it, then I think we're kind of doing our nation a disservice. Because from the very beginning of this country, we basically said that we're a country of inclusion. And it's time, it seems to me, for us to figure out what does that really mean on the ground.
I want to go back to the phones now and take a call from Julie in Madison. Welcome, Julie. You're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm a grad student studying social work, and we've been studying race, of course, but we've also been really thinking about white privilege and how that is not really addressed much in racial studies, but whites need to actually think about what it means to be white and what being white in our culture gets us, and that's kind of how we process racism in a more personal way, because, yes, we don't think we are racist, but we have a lot of advantages just by society and how it's structured that we get because of being white.
Thanks a lot for that call, Julie. And Yolanda Moses?
Well, she's absolutely right. One of the things we try to do is bring in the current literature, the current research around the issue. And when you go there, you'll see this big section that says inventing whiteness, because so many times, because, you know, people in power can structure the dialogue, whiteness is left out of the equation when we talk about the various different kinds of colors. But by including it, it becomes part of the dynamic. And in doing so, it's the impact of all those white presidents. It's the impact of the laws since 1790 in this country that have systematically been against bringing immigrants of color into this country. It's when you pull all that together, you start seeing that white privilege and that it means something to be white in American society, the same way that it means something to be of other, quote-unquote, racial colors. And until we deconstruct that, then I think we're constantly just talking among people who don't have the power to make all the changes that need to be made. And I know Michael has something to say about this, too.
Well, sure. Just to follow up a little, that there's a very interesting study by Ruth Frankenberg in California, and there are others who've pointed to this phenomenon, in which many people of European descent in the United States believe that they are not part of even a socially defined race, that there are no races in the social way, and that they are certainly not part of a group. They are just normal individuals, Americans. And that is, if you consider our understanding of the discrimination that takes place, you look at the data, if you consider what many people of color see when they see someone of European descent, they see somebody in a particular category in relationship to them who stands to do better when it comes to loans and health care and so on down the line. So it's a kind of, to stand there and say, I'm not anything, is a little insulting, perhaps. And it denies this relationship. It denies the historical relationship between white people today and, you know, those presidents. They weren't just Americans. Those presidents weren't just normal people. Thomas Jefferson was able to do what he did in good part because he was a white man who could own and enslave people and had certain relationships based on his whiteness. And that, and though he sort of was not good with money, unfortunately for his family, there's, you know, a great deal of wealth that came to people like him, and that comes down to people who are still constructed as white. And it's important to recognize that.
Well, that's interesting, too, because if people are saying, I'm just normal, it sort of paints being you know, white American as the default position, what is normal that makes everyone else something other than normal.
That's right. And this, again, it's presented and often thought of as a position that stands for equality. What it actually is a position that represents another form of white supremacy, the normal and then the abnormal or more positioned, subjective other people.
Right. Well, let's go back to the phones. Here's a call from Adrian joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Adrian.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First-time caller, I'm a little nervous, but I first want to say that I saw the race exhibit when I was living in Minnesota three times. I went with my family, and then I took friends back, and then I actually ended up taking students back when I was teaching, and it affected me rather profoundly. I particularly enjoyed the census portion that highlighted the fact that there's now an option to select multiracial. But I moved to Milwaukee in October and had an interesting experience with institutional racism when I decided I was going to go and get my Wisconsin driver's license. And I was informed that I had to select one race and that it was required by law that I write down a race, that multiracial, biracial, and other were considered too vague by the Department of Transportation. And I found myself in quite a predicament because I've always identified, you know, as black and white, and I really got the sense that they wanted me basically just to write down what color I am, but I'm fairly light-skinned, and I didn't know what to do. And so basically, I've been trying to find a way to start a dialogue about this, but I haven't a clue where to start, so I was wondering if you had any comments on that.
Thank you so much for that call, Adrian. And that's something, you know, I've had some experience with, too, being someone whose father was Mexican, my mother is German, and it is hard to just check one box, and you wonder what the use is of boiling it down like that.
Well, historically, your caller is someone who is part of a growing, huge population in the United States that belies the history and the tradition of how our institutions are categorizing people. So the census is about, you know, at least a decade behind what is happening in the in our own country, and we have to help them catch up with it. So there are national associations and national groups of multi-ethnic folks, and you know, I'd be happy to provide you with that information offline if you'd like. There are people who are pushing to change the institutions, the federal institutions, state institutions, so that multi-racial categories are there, and people have the ability to write in whatever they want to write in about their identity.
Do you believe that it is useful to, I know that you were told when you were working on the census and those questions, you both were told that it was necessary for reasons of bureaucracy. What is your take on that? Do you think that's accurate, or do you think there is a more useful way to do this?
I mean, I think it's accurate to a certain extent. Of course, they want at the end of the year to show, you know, our census. We've been doing that since 1790, so that is a part of the fabric of our country, knowing who the people are in the United States as they're categorized by the Census Bureau, right? But there are also uses by Department of Education, Department of Labor, Department of Defense to, in the case of Department of Labor, to make sure, and this is something some of the civil rights groups told us, to make sure that the federal government is reaching those populations that have been historically disenfranchised to make sure that their programs are reaching the mark. And you do that by collecting data on people and how they're doing. And this is how, at least this is, that's the pushback that the federal government gets and that people get from either adding categories or taking categories away.
And in addition to that, in the 2000 census that was advised by the American Anthropological Association under Yolanda's leadership, the Census Bureau and OMB ended up with a practice of allowing individuals to check off more than one category, which is more realistic in terms of the historic, the ancestry, the diverse ancestry of people in the United States. Unfortunately, the categories are still awfully limited. And at the same time, the positive part of that is, as Yolanda described it, the ability to track what's happening in relationship to race and make correctives in relationship to race. So there has been some change, and your previous caller should have brought to the attention of her employer that the U.S. Census allows an individual to check off more than one box.
Well, maybe the DMV doesn't, but...
Right.
We're talking this hour about the new exhibit from the American Anthropological Association called Race, Are We So Different? It's currently being seen in Minnesota and will be touring the country. If you'd like to check it out online, their website is www.understandingrace.org. That's understandingrace.org. We're wondering this hour what you think. Are we ready to move beyond race? And what are some new and helpful ways to think about race, or maybe even just to talk about race? If you've seen the exhibit, we'd also love to hear from you this hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 2 o'clock today, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. How do you go from hops, grain, water, and yeast to porter and lager? After 2 on Science Friday, live from Milwaukee, I'll look at, you guessed it, the science of brewing beer. Plus, how expert beer tasters judge what makes a good brew. That's Talk of the Nation Science Friday after 2 o'clock today. Today it's live from Milwaukee. We hope you'll join us for that. I'm Veronica Rickert, back with you in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the exciting new exhibit, Race, Are We So Different? From the American Anthropological Association, talking with two guests from the project, Yolanda Moses from the University of California, Riverside, and Michael Blakey, the director for the Institute of for Historical Biology at the College of William and Mary. And we do have more folks on the line waiting to talk to you both, so let's get back to them and take a call from Elizabeth in Washburn. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm 86, and when I have to fill out forms and they put down race, I always put human. The person that takes it always either laughs or smiles. They don't get angry, and they say, it's not acceptable. And I just say, you do with it whatever you want to. And only, I mean, at 86, I can do this. I mean, if I were 26, they'd give me the business. But at 86, I can get away with it. And it's, I'm just hoping someday they will put down skin color and let it go at that.
Thank you for that call, Elizabeth. That's a, it's an interesting take. I think I've heard that from one or two other people who do that sort of grassroots, I don't know.
Resistance.
Resistance, right. Have you guys heard of anyone doing that before?
Oh, yes. Yes, people do. I know people who do that.
Again, not sure how that's going to go over at the DMV, but other cases might do pretty well. Let's take another call from Chris in Pulaski. Hello, Chris. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes, I was just wondering if like Obama's is half white, genetically half white and half black. But I kind of wish he would have just said, I'm a white man, instead of saying I'm a black man, and see where the controversy goes from there, because then it'd really bring the case forward.
So what do you think would come from doing that?
What do I think?
Right.
Well, I think what it would do is it would bring it out where it had to be discussed on a national basis, because that's really the crux of the problem, is crossing these lines and getting rid of this whole color issue, because it's obsolete at this point.
All right. Thanks very much for that call, Chris. And Michael Blakey, what do you think about that idea?
Well, I think the issue has been broached simply by being who he is. There is a very positive and important sentiment in, I think, what both of the last callers have said, that it's important to get beyond race. And at the same time, just to sort of deny it on a form, while that may be an important moment of protest, certainly can be, going beyond race requires dealing with the institutions that perpetuate racism. And that has to be done in ways that also acknowledge the power of race. And it's also important, it seems to me, that we recognize the cultural variation, the variation in ancestries, in family histories, in ethnic group histories, and that we not dismiss the richness of those levels of diversity that are embodied in terms like African American or Korean American or Irish American, while we are getting beyond the discrimination based on color.
And I think that Michael has hit the point of this exhibit. We want to pull apart what people believe to be race so that they can put it back together again in a way that helps them understand who they are and their place in the race, in this racialized world. And it's so racialized, and you've said it before, that it has become the default position not to talk about it. And so when you bring it, when you talk about it, it's almost as if you're bringing up something that we have gotten past, that we shouldn't talk about. And I think the election of the running of Obama as a candidate, as Chris is saying, gives us the opportunity to interrogate who he is. Is he the son of African man, or is he the son of a white woman? And what does he think he is? Who does he think he is? How does he identify? And how do we provide opportunities and spaces for that kind of discussion at a national level, but also at a local level, and even at a family level?
Well, we thank you for those calls, and we go now to Marty in Douglas County. Hello, Marty. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Veronica.
Morning.
I just have a couple of little logistical corrections for you. The Science Museum of Minnesota is in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Okay.
And the exhibit itself is actually in Mashantucket, Connecticut right now on the...
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, Mashantucket Pequot Museum.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Yeah. So just so people don't think they can run over to,
okay,
to Minnesota.
Well, that's good, because St. Paul's in driving distance, not so much the other location.
Right, exactly. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
And it started with Minnesota Science Museum, Science Museum of Minnesota, whose staff were the designers. And so, yes, absolutely. It's important to know that it's not there at the moment, but I just want to make sure everyone knows that that museum put a lot of fundamental effort into creating this exhibition with the anthropologists and other scientists.
Can you give us a sense of some of the other cities that the exhibit will be touring?
Well, yes. It went from Minneapolis to Detroit, Michigan, and went from Detroit to New Jersey Science Center, and then now it's in Connecticut, and it will be going to Cleveland, it will be going to Kansas, and it will be going to the Smithsonian Natural History Museum.
Hmm.
And we have a waiting list of 14 other museums who want to get on the list.
That's wonderful news.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But that's been since the beginning. So we're looking at trying to raise funds to do a second major exhibit, and also we have funds to do a smaller exhibit that will travel to not only smaller museums, but to universities and to schools, so we can impact curriculum.
Moving on now, we'll take another call, this time from Sandra, joining us from Fort Atkinson. Hello, Sandra.
Hi. Your program is very interesting. And it brings back a memory of something my mother told to me a long time ago, when I was in grammar school, my parents were getting divorced, and she had to go to work. So she had to hire somebody to take care of my sister and I after school. And she hired this woman who was black, and she said to me, after she had hired her, she said, you know, it's a terrible shame. That woman has a college education. She is smarter than I am. She has more ability than I have, and she has to take a job taking care of children instead of being able to go out and get a good job. And she said it's all because she's dark-skinned. And I'm so grateful to my mother for giving me the right ideas about people. More parents can do a lot for their children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing your story with us, Sandra. We appreciate that.
One other thing. Mm-hmm. One time riding, I was in Texas. We were going on a bus, and a man was sitting next to me. My mother and sister were in a seat behind. And as we talked, he said, oh, you're from Chicago. He said, oh, yeah, you've got all those darkies up there, but you people don't know how to take care of them. We see that they don't have to walk on the side. They don't walk on the sidewalk with us. And it gave me a really bad idea about people in Texas. Mm-hmm. And I certainly hope that if I was down there today, I would not hear anything like that.
Well, I'm glad that story's from a long time ago. We all know that having to overcome that sort of thing is something that's still with us today. It's something we're still working against. And
it's so unfair, so very unfair. But at any rate, I'm glad that things are changing, because I see now here in Fort, I've seen not very many, but some people of, you know, different skin colors, and there doesn't seem to be that kind of thought anymore. The kids are all playing together and don't seem to pay any attention to that, which is great. Anyway, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your call, Sandra. And we'll take a call now from Yvonne in Brown Deer. Hi, Yvonne, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. What a fascinating program. My contribution is that all my life I wondered why Jesus was he's presented to us as being born, you know, with Jewish parents. And then we get to see him blonde, blue-eyed, and white. And I think that has had a real negative effect. When I was growing up, one of the slang things to prove how wonderful you were was that you were free, white, and over 21. And there are so many things that worked into that. My problem with this has always been I have all the inheritance from the British Isles, from France, there's some from Germany, and Native American. And the one thing that if I ever talked about Native American, that got the most negative response. And that hurts because we took this country away from them and we haven't been very good to them.
Well, thank you for your call, Yvonne. And Michael Blakey and Yolanda Moses, as you can hear from some of the callers, they have these memories that really painfully remind us of just how bad things were, maybe how far we've yet to come. But I also think listening to them that some of the stories would be much more unusual if they were happening today. What do you think?
Well, it's very interesting. One of the places that keeps people in our exhibit so long is a place where people are telling stories just like the ones that have been told. And these are from 2007. So it is, yes, in some ways it has gotten better. As Michael said, a lot of this goes kind of underground. And a lot of times people say things that they don't even think are hurtful. And they are. And what is brought out is that it's so embedded, these sayings that, you know, to be white, you make assumptions about other people, what they are and what they are not. And the stories from these folks have the same kind of passion and emotion. We have students, contemporary students, who tell very similar stories about themselves and how they are perceived and how they're treated. So we do still have a long way to go. And I think the personal stories probably hit people more than anything because they connect and they say, oh, it's an aha moment. So this is where I put this feeling that I've always had. So, and we hope to do a lot more of that.
I teach a course called The Idea of Race that draws, that uses the website material for the race exhibition as well. And there are all kinds of students in the class. And we've, you know, it's clear that there has been some change that's important. And in other areas, as Yolanda says, in other regards, you still hear some of the same expression. Or
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut.
Insidious
Michael,
level.
I'm that's sorry, we're out of time. We'll have to leave it there. And I want to make sure to give the website once more so people know where to find you. But I want to thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Talking with Yolanda Moses from the University of California, Riverside, and Michael Blakey from the College of William and Mary. The exhibit we're talking about is Race, Are We So Different?, which can be found online at www.understandingrace.org. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.